All year round, Frontier Home Products and Design has what you need to make your home comfortable and beautiful. Relax on a new timber tech deck designed by Frontier's experts. A new fireplace from Frontier Home Products Fireplace Gallery adds warmth and serenity to any home. Beauty and versatility at Frontier Home Products and Design Center, 4213 Peachtree, 5th next to the Bayfront Highway.
Frontier Home Products and Design Center. Discover a new frontier.
PA contractor number PA039007.
Welcome to TalkErie.com's Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast. Every day, we tackle the biggest issues that the Erie, PA region faces. Stay informed and involved as we advance the narrative of Erie. Now, here's Joel Natale.
We want to welcome back an old friend of mine here, Pastor Derek Sanford. He is the senior pastor of Grace Church and the dean of the Grace Leadership Institute. Derek, welcome.
Thanks, Joel. It's good to be here.
I've been looking forward to this conversation so much because we're talking about leadership today.
Yeah.
And I consider you an amazing leader, both for your church, but for our community and really greater across the country. And something occurs to me, and I'm just going to throw you a curveball right off the bat. To be a great leader, don't you need folks to be good followers?
Well, yeah, yes. And I mean, the great quote that I always love is that says, if you think you're a leader but have no followers, you're only taking a walk.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously, I think one of the skills of leadership is being able to bring together people toward a common goal and a common cause. And so I don't know that people need to be good followers to follow a leader, but I think their followership is part of the leadership process.
Yeah, but we, every once in a while, we'll encounter somebody that they're contrarian for contrarian's sake sometimes.
Right.
And that's just, you know, that'll give you a little ulcer every once in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I do think part of the leadership process of becoming a good leader is learning how to first be a good follower. That's part of the developmental process. Not you don't just come out of the womb as a leader.
You know,
you got to be able to have experienced good leadership yourself and learned how to follow someone else, because I think that positions you better to be able to lead people and to call them to something greater than themselves.
I think it's John Maxwell who says, he kind of defines leadership as basically being a person of influence. Weigh in on that.
Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, that's the simplest definition of leadership, I think. You know, leadership, I think his quote is, leadership is influence, nothing more, nothing less. Now, I'm not sure I fully agree with that little caveat at the end, but I think influence, I mean, when you define it in those simple of terms, you know, it really positions everybody in some level of leadership. And so if you are a parent, you know, you have influence over your kids. And so whether you'd consider yourself a great leader or not, sorry, you are one,
right?
Because they're following you and you're setting an example for them and you're, you know, helping them to achieve things that they haven't achieved yet and that sort of thing. That's what leaders do. And so, you know, I do think that influence is a huge part of what it means to be a leader. You know, I think spiritual leadership, when you start, I mean, that's one of the arenas that I'm passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
Spiritual leadership, you know, I think the best definition I've heard on that is Henry Blackaby, who says spiritual leadership is moving people onto God's agenda. And I like that idea that you're helping people to see what God has for them and to see how God has created them and then to see what God's plan is in the world and helping them to kind of get on those train tracks, you know?
Well, and I would think that anyone that's in the marketplace, if they are a person of faith, they could use that definition for anybody who's following them, no matter where they are on the spectrum, the continuum. You know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's a broad enough definition that it captures everyone. And I think that, you know, whether somebody, regardless of what kind of faith background somebody has, there is this sense for a leader to say, hey, God is at work in the world. God is doing something bigger than us. And man, if I can help us move toward those really positive, really profound healing, justice, mercy kind of initiatives, the world's going to be a better place.
Talk about how you came up and the leaders that were around you.
Oh, man. My first influential leader is my dad.
Yeah.
My dad had a massive impact on my life. He was a teacher and a coach. A lot of people around the Erie area know my dad. And it's always
Joe Sanford.
Yeah. He was at Corey for many years, McDowell for many years, and then, you know, all variety of other colleges and high schools. And I think he coached
still defining the art of pole vaulting even to what, the fourth generation or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Now,
absolutely. So, you know, growing up in a coach's home.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, being raised by Vince Lombardi or so, you know, it's like he, you know, all these phrases, and he's a leader of men. And, you know, he just had the ability to motivate people toward a goal. Mm. And the thing I love about my dad, and I think my dad is a very profound example for people who may be, you know, who are a Christian, who don't work in a church necessarily, but who work in a job or in a school or a business or a shop or whatever. My dad is one of the first examples to me of somebody who was living out their calling in their job.
Yeah.
Because he was more than just a coach. I mean, the number of times that I'm out at a restaurant with my dad these days, and people just come up and say, you know, you were a father to me, you were a older brother to me, you changed my life, you gave me hope, you helped me find my purpose. Because what my dad would do is, it was much more than just coaching and wins and losses. He cared about each individual player. And, you know, when he was at McDowell, I mean, we'd have 100 kids on the football team, 200, 300 kids on the track team. I mean, it was a massive thing.
Wow.
And he knew every person's name. Without help, he knew stuff about their families. He knew, and if that kid got a sprained ankle, or he got hurt, or had to go to the hospital, or was having problems at home, my dad would be at their front door. He'd be in the hospital room. I mean, he was a pastor of those kids.
Amazing.
And my dad was a big influence. I had a guy in college. He was actually the dean of Taylor University at the time when I was at Taylor, Wynn Lembright, who invested in me. And Jay Kessler, you may recognize
that
name.
Yeah, I know that name.
Jay Kessler, he was the president of Youth for Christ nationally for a long time, and then was the president of Taylor University for a long time.
Wow.
Those two guys in administration, when I came in as a student, so to have the president and the dean kind of take notice of you and invest in you, I'll never forget. I led my first, I was a Bible major at Taylor, okay, so I led my first student Bible study. And I'll never forget looking up. There's, you know, 30 kids in the room or whatever. We were in somebody's living room, and I'm you know, nervous as heck trying to work through this material. And I look up and I see the dean of the university sitting in the room with his notebook open, taking notes from a 19-year-old. And it had such a profound impact on me, of the humility of leadership, that servant leadership. That I think is
that you still have something to learn even from a 19-year-old.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're 60 and you've got your notebook open ready to see what I can take away from this. And I just think that, like, lifelong learner model, but also the humility of leadership, of just going, I anybody can learn from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And if you walk into the room as a leader, like you're the know-it-all, or you have the corner on the market of truth or whatever, you've lost already. But if you walk in going, I not only do I have something to give here, but I have something to learn from every person in this circle, you're going to be the kind of leader that people want to follow. And that was the example that he was to me.
We learned a lot through the years, through Jim Collins and the idea of a level 5 leader, right? That servant leadership, where if something goes well, it's the team that made it happen. And if something, goes in the toilet, it was all my fault. The leader takes responsibility. Are enough people that are in the marketplace as well as in nonprofits and in the faith world, are they still resonating with that kind of thing?
So it's,
and we'll talk about politics too, you know?
Yeah, so it's funny to me. I think that is a real key, and the thing that I always cracked up about Jim Collins, and there's been a number of other experts that have come out and talked about this kind of humility and leadership concept.
Yeah.
And the thing that cracks me up is, like, Jesus told us this 2,000 years ago. Like, and it's like the business world is just catching up with this. Oh,
right.
Maybe there's something to this that actually makes somebody a better leader when they're humble and when they see the good in others and when they pull out the best in others and when they give credit and take blame, mm-hmm. kind of thing. My concern is that in the church world, it's gone the other direction, that we've started so the business world is kind of coming back to biblical principles and the church world in some ways has left biblical principles and started to adopt business models of leadership instead of recognizing that, man, Jesus was onto something, you know, and he was an innovator. If we could talk this basically,
yeah,
he was an innovator of humility that until Jesus, there's a great book written called Humilitas, but until Jesus, humility was seen as a great weakness.
Yeah.
And when Jesus came, and really you can trace it after that, it all of a sudden became a strength and is becoming more and more a strength. And he literally came and made a humility revolution in the world. It went from being a bad thing, a thing to be embarrassed of, to being a very positive and powerful thing.
Well, if you study the early church, you know, the reason why the Christians... Yeah. We're so remarkable is because of, quote, the way.
Yeah.
The way they approached, you know, poor people and sick people and so on was so different. It was so countercultural. It was revolutionary,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it was. And that was back when Christians were known not from what they shouted from the stages, but from how they lived their lives. It was called the way of life that they lived.
The way of life. Wow.
Yeah.
The when we talk about... humility in leadership, when we talk about, you know, getting people together for something bigger than ourselves, is that still kind of the crying pain that all of us have in our hearts? I want to be significant. I want to be a part of something bigger than myself.
I think so. I think there's a longing inside of us to have, I mean, ultimately it comes down to purpose.
Yeah.
I think we all want to have a purpose in life, and that purpose is this thing out there that I can join with others in chasing. And you know, I think that, you know, we're talking a lot about story these days, and that people are settling for a lesser story. You know, that there's this beautiful big story out there that's being written in the world, and that, you know, a lot of people's story is just too small. Like, we want to be part of a bigger story. The problem is a lot of people settle for being a part of a cause, but never get to their purpose. And so, you know, to scratch that itch, people will, you know, dive headlong into a political party or dive headlong into a cause or into a something that they want to protest or, you know, all these kind of things. And to me, those are kind of lesser expressions of this big story that God is writing in the world.
Derek Sanford is our guest, and Derek is the dean of the Grace Leadership Institute. Well, give us the mission of the Grace Leadership Institute. What were you trying to do there?
Yeah, this is a local expression of really trying to raise up leaders locally. And it's to help people to understand not only the scriptures and theology, but to understand how God has wired them to be a leader wherever they are. And so we've got a couple of different branches there. There's a school of ministry that's very much geared toward, you know, Bible and theology. There's a leadership development center, which is really geared toward just straight leadership, helping people to be better leaders where they find themselves. And then there's what we call the Regional Church Collaborative, which is really geared for church leaders. And it is what it says. It's a collaboration where we just had a great session on Monday night. We've got a lot of open forums and panel discussions. Monday night, we had a great conversation about the church and Gen Z. And some of the challenges there of reaching and raising up the next generation with how the church is perceived right now in our culture and even among that generation.
So we don't just have to, like, serve pizza and have games with balloons and silly string.
We did when you and I were coming up, but that's, I think, where it ended.
That's right. Well, hey, I remember those fifth quarters that you had in the basement of 38th and of Colonial. My gosh, 150 kids
crammed in there.
Yeah,
smelled like junior high kids.
So what were some of the takeaways from that Gen Z conversation?
Oh man, I'll tell you, it was just so fascinating. We had Daryl Cook was the moderator, and we had Caleb Fugate, who's over at Wesley United Methodist, and Will Bacher, who is the youth lead at Grace these days. And so it was kind of the three of them and then the people in the room, but just some fascinating takeaways about, you know, the differences generationally. Mm-hmm. But one of the thing, two things that I found really fascinating. So, you know, Gen Z is all about, first of all, they're incredibly motivated. They have, they have all of the tools that they need to be successful earlier than any other. We were talking about these 16-year-olds who are making $100,000 doing X, Y, and Z on the side on the internet while they're taking classes and stuff. I mean, so there, it's a very kind of a motivated entrepreneurial kind of thing, and as angsty as the millennials were above them.
Yeah.
They're the kind of the parents. Gen Z is kind of revolting against the angstiness and the and by kind of being more motivated and go-getters kind of thing. But the thing that Will said that I thought was super fascinating was he said, you know, obviously it's the age of anxiety. So many kids are suffering with mental health struggles, and anxiety and depression is on the rise. And he said the simple answer is to say that that social media causes that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think there's some, you know, obviously some effect there.
Yeah.
But he said, I think that's overstated. He said, this group of kids is so inclusive of everyone. They just want everyone to have a voice, everyone to have a seat at the table, everyone to be included, to have safe space to express themselves. Like, that's a huge value of this group. He said, can you imagine the anxiety of trying to include everybody all the time and walking on eggshells, afraid that you're going to call somebody the wrong thing, or not include somebody the way they want to be included, or whatever. It's such a value that he goes, I think that's the reason for all the anxiety, is that it's actually an overflow of what's a very positive thing about that generation that they've kind of taken to the extreme, and now are walking on eggshells, just trying to keep everybody happy all the time.
That's a far cry from somebody throwing a kick me sign on my back.
Exactly.
I think about, you know, I mean, I loved my high school experience, but my gosh, it was brutal, you know?
Well, that's the thing. He's like, exactly, far cry. I heard somebody talking about back in the day, like, you used to nickname people for their greatest weakness. Like, they're,
yeah, I was slim. I was Slim Natale, literally, and I embraced it.
I'm sure you did. You would embrace it again too if somebody called you.
Yes, I would.
That.
Yeah, I'm trying, Derek. No, so I'm sorry. I don't want to get us off a rail because we can laugh the rest of the show. So these are really important conversations that are happening at GLI. I mean, and I notice that, like, you know, the nonprofit partnership is having stuff over there. It's just really a really high-end facility, and it's so perfectly located there on 7th and Holland. You know?
We love it. We really, as we were remodeling it, I mean, the cool history is that that's actually our original church building, the Swedish Baptist Church.
I told you that I read the article when they were building it in the old newspaper. It's crazy, yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
So 1906, you know, they built that building, the Swedes that were here, Swedish immigrants, yes. And so anyway, you know, it's really a joy to be back in there. Mm-hmm. But when we were renovating and we put a lot of money and effort into that building, we just wanted to make it a world-class training facility. And I think we've accomplished that.
I think you absolutely did.
Yeah.
When we talk about, you know, the kind of training and access to training, and I know that, you know, Grace is a host site for the Global Leadership Summit coming out of the Willow Creek Association. What else have you found that people get super excited about when it comes to leadership training around here?
Yeah, so I think that would go two ways. I think one is, you know, I've been amazed. So I've been teaching a three-part curriculum that I wrote. Oh. It's about leadership. So it's the calling of a leader, the character of a leader, the competencies of a leader. So three parts. We made a little certificate out of it. It's a pretty cool program. One of the things that I noticed, though, was the neutral space for people from different industries to come and just learn good leadership stuff.
Yeah.
And as much as businesses around and different companies do their own leadership development for their employees, mm-hmm. there was just something magical about being in the room with a doctor in the back, an accountant over here, an ear insurance executive over here, you know, different people from all kinds of different backgrounds. Studying what kind of character qualities does a good leader exhibit, and how do we get there? It was magic, and so I think just having that like neutral kind of cross disciplinary space where people can come and explore this is really profound, and I think it's something that you can't really find anywhere else. I think it's something we're offering that's very, very unique.
Do you feel that people are dying to take the time away from the minutiae of operating their organizations or their businesses to say, how do I get better at these kinds of skill sets?
Yeah, I don't think they know they need it until
okay.
they're in it.
Interesting.
I mean, I think it's one of those things that, you know, as people have walked away from these classes, they're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I took so long in signing up for that. You know, it's kind of that thing. But, you know, I mean... Everybody's on the hamster wheel, and it's hard when you're on it to go, hey, maybe I should step off this for a minute and get better at what I'm doing, or get better at time management so I don't have to be on this hamster wheel all the time, or get to a place where I could have a bigger influence in a different sector, and you know, that sort of thing. So I would love to see that hunger and that need amplified in people, and for people to take a moment and go, man, if I just got better at this, it would make a big difference in my life.
Derek, I want you to finish your thought here, because you were saying, first point was talking about what, individual
leadership. Yeah, but the second thing I was going to say is that the need that I think this is filling, that people don't quite know about yet, is just the need for biblical and theological training for people in the church.
Yeah.
And I think there's just generally been a drift away from robust training in this area in the church. We've moved toward kind of a I don't need to get into all the academic stuff. I just need to have faith kind of thing. And I really see this as, you know, we're bringing in some of the best Bible teachers at colleges around here. Chris Ansberry is teaching a class right now from Grove City College on how to read and interpret the Bible today. It's a profound class. We've got Daniel DeWitt coming in. We've got Solgi Bjun coming in, who's one of the best Old Testament teachers I've ever
Did you get that
across.
Thing, that connection with Wheaton going? Or
Yeah, so that's on hold.
It's on hold, okay.
Yeah, it's on hold. It's still there, but we're working on, we need to get a cohort of about 15 people to go through that master's program. So it's just taking some time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
To build up to
that.
But yeah, we're going to have a Wheaton extension here in Erie as soon as we get that cohort together, which is a really amazing thing. That's one of the best colleges in the world.
Ed Stetzer. He was there at Wheaton. Now I think he moved out.
Yeah, he's at Biola.
Biola, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's warmer.
Yeah. Chicago to Southern California. Yeah.
Sorry, Biola is just, that was a Trump.
Exactly.
That trumped it.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, that's super cool because, you're right. It's we've always been that, two ends of a spectrum here. Either you have, that big doctoral, a doctor of ministry degree from a traditional seminary, or I just kind of got ordained and, started my own church kind of thing.
Yeah. And I mean, that is kind of part of the vision for that place. Yeah. It's just cause I mean, when I was coming in as a pastor in the '80s, in the late '80s, it was like, you need to have your degree to even get a job in a church. Mm-hmm. Like you need to be MDiv or something.
Yeah.
At least you're working toward your master's degree or a Bible degree or something. And, within 10 years, partly the church planting, multi-site like that, the need to get more pastors quick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did for my master's thesis, I did an interview with a bunch of big multi-site churches around the country and just said, hey, how do you train young pastors? Or what are you looking for when you hire a young pastor? They literally, every one of them said, we bring them on our staff for a year and hope they catch our culture, and then they're a pastor. And I mean, it went from literal like, 6 years of training to, we hope you catch our culture.
How do you know if they're, well, how do you know if they're
like a
interpreting
cold.
The Bible in a, right, in exactly. an orthodox manner? No, my gosh.
Exactly. So it's like, we're going to hire hirelings and we'll handle the thinking. And it's like, so we're trying to get back to at least a middle space mm-hmm. that says, you know, you don't have to go get your doctorate degree in theology, but man, we want to provide you some robust, legitimate training.
Amazing.
in the Bible right here in Erie. We wanted to make it accessible. And we, you know, we could have partnered with a college like Grove City or something sure. like that and done just an undergrad program here. We were just concerned that the same academic, the entrance standards, mm-hmm. if you do that, are just the same. So if somebody can't afford it in Grove City, and if they can't get in Grove City, they couldn't get in here either.
Gotcha.
And we just wanted to make it more accessible to that, to the everyday person, so that you could come take a class, audit a class, have world-class teaching.
Right.
But do it right here at home.
That's amazing to have that at that facility. Yeah. Let's pivot to kind of in where we started, where, you know, to be a good follower, to be part of something greater than yourselves, it's going to take time, talent, treasures, right? And you wrote a book about, basically giving agency
yeah.
to members of your community through really respecting volunteers enough to say, you know what? You have a brain. You could probably lead something here. I'm not sure I'm totally on the money here. But yeah, talk about it.
Yeah, so the book I wrote is called Untapped Church. And the idea is that word untapped means available but not used. Mm. And so the premise is that there's a lot of churches around a lot of places that have people who are available but not being used in the church and for God's kingdom. And so, you know, part of it is just telling Grace's story. Because like you said, you know, there came a point, we've been doing it for a long time now.
Yeah.
But we're just giving away huge amounts of ministry to people and really entrusting them to do the things that they have the capacity already to do. But there have been these, you know, things holding them back, from doing them. And so, yeah, right now, 2/3 of our staff is not paid. They're volunteers. So when we have our staff meeting, you know, 2/3 of the people in the room are volunteer leaders that we've entrusted to very, very important roles in the church. I'll never remember my first aha moment that we had something unique there was when I walked in. So our site at Grace McCain was about 1,000 people. So a church of 1,000, that's a pretty sizable church.
Yeah.
I walked into our staff meeting. It was about 20 people in the staff meeting that is running that congregation. So from the pastor to the children's ministry director to the youth director to the guest experience, all of the people in the room. I walked into that room of 20 people running our largest site, and there was one part-time worship person in there. Everyone else in the room was a volunteer. So
we
had a room of 20 volunteers running a church of 1,000 people with no paid staff, essentially. There was one part-time worship person. So it was like, I left that room and go, that's unusual.
Yeah, it sure
I don't think there's that's happening a lot. And so I started.
Where did because that's much more closer to kind of original stuff, right? Yeah. Well, even if for some of us that grew up in the Catholic Church, we had a priest.
Yeah.
But everything else had to be handled by volunteers, ushers, you know, there's always a big power play who was the head of the usher society, right? You know, but he got to wear the special jacket, you know, but no, I'm making a joke, but it's true. I mean, that was a very important volunteer and he had a lot of responsibility. How do we get off to these professional staffs? Because now there's these artificial lines to say, hey, if you really want an answer to why we need more diapers in the children's ministry, you got to ask the paid staffer for that, you know.
It's true, yeah, and it is an interesting history. To be honest with you, I'm trying to write a second book, and part of that book is going to be to track down this history of when did we actually start paying clergy, you know, and I realize that there's always been, you know, at least a barter system or something going on all the way
Pride
back.
And Prejudice, you know, was the benefactor, what was it, the aunt that kept the guy in line. Anyway,
exactly.
Go ahead.
You know, exactly.
Right.
So, but yeah, it is interesting that we've gotten to the place, and I do think it's just such a departure from the biblical model. Like, yeah. I don't think Jesus ever looked forward to his church and was like, I imagine the day when everybody that runs my church is going to be, you know, paid a full-time salary in it. Like, I think we've gotten away from some of those principles that the church was actually built on.
Well, I don't know if you watched The Chosen at all, but there's a couple great segments there where Peter's a tradesman. You know, he's pouring concrete. I'm sure it's not concrete, but they're fixing a sewer. And I love that concept of, you know what, I go and work.
Yep.
You know, I'm a tent maker, and I go and I bring, you know, what I can to the greater good, you know.
I have a chapter in my book that's titled Everybody's Bivocational.
Yeah.
So, when we hear that word in the church world anyway, we hear that word bivocational, it's usually applied to pastors. It's a pastor who has a part-time job and then works part-time at the church or whatever, or has two jobs. And the reality is, I think the biblical model is, because it's very much a spiritual gifts-based model, an empowerment model by Jesus, is that everybody kind of has two jobs.
Yeah.
You know, there's what Paul had two jobs. Like, you go through, that there are very few examples of people who just did ministry full time. It's like, no, I work in the world, and I serve in and through my church.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's the calling for everybody.
Is there, takeaway values here that maybe a CEO, an executive director of a nonprofit could use, or maybe even, you know, somebody who's doing a startup that's kind of bringing in family and friends to say, hey, I need help, you know, getting these jars of jelly filled, you know.
There's tons of, and in fact, one of my regrets, and I really considered this as I was writing the book, one of my regrets of calling it Untapped Church is it does feel like it eliminates those other things, but I think it's incredibly helpful to those. In fact, I've been going around speaking at nonprofit events and things for nonprofit leaders, because there are such transferable principles here. At its base level, it's how do you empower people to do great work, and how do you lead, you know, people? I personally think leading volunteer leaders is one of the highest levels of leadership. You know, I mean, if you're a CEO and if you can pay people and you can add to that pay or take away from that pay based on performance, you have very clear levers that you can pull to get what you want. It's a whole different level of leadership that you have to find whole different kinds of motivation and how do people process things to be able to lead and envision and inspire volunteers. And so I just think it's a high level of leadership to be able to do that. So I feel like if you can put into practice some of the principles in this book, they will apply across any level of leadership.
I've always noticed in my years that when people are let in on the thinking, on the vision, when it is this visceral conversation and the leader is open to, you know, for input and things, that it's not just a closed down deal, but it's like, you know, here's what we're working on. What do you think? And you let people in on the ground floor, as it were. It just fires passion.
100%. And why we don't do that more often is a mystery to me. And I do think that, you know, there's a control freak thing going
on. Gotcha.
There's some of that stuff that plays in. But the truth is, Joel, I mean, think about it. No, I don't know. Pastors don't know how to do everything.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, there's people in our churches that know how to do all kinds of things that we don't know how to do. So why would we not have them at the table helping to solve problems?
Those financial wizards are sitting, you know, whether it's in your pew or, you know, sending you a $50 check every month.
Right.
Find out about them.
Right.
And I don't know what it would take. Does it take, hey, we're going to invite either donors or we're going to invite people, whoever is interested, and have a lunch and, you know, do a gifts assessment.
Yeah.
I mean, some of those things could be really beneficial. I don't know.
They really could. I think it the first step is just curiosity and creativity on the part of the leader.
Yeah.
Just to realize that there are people out there that know stuff that I don't know. And I mean, our process was painfully simple when we first started doing this. We looked at what we called our growth engines. We said, okay, what are some growth engines in our church that if they had good leadership, they would propel us forward in some certain area? And so we identified those. We came up with five or six of them. Then we said, who are our high capacity leaders? And who's out there that's untapped? They're available but not being used, but we know they know things, or they can influence people or whatever. And we literally went to them and just said, hey, would you consider coming onto our staff without pay and helping us solve these big problems? And I think a lot of times what church leaders do is we undersell. It won't take you any time. It's going to be so easy. You'll be able to do this in your spare time. And that's not what leaders want to hear. Leaders want to hear it's going to take your best time. And you're going to have to give some stuff up.
And you might wake up at 3 a.m. thinking about this problem.
But that's what motivates leaders. They're like, okay, that's a problem big enough for me. It's not holding babies in the nurse. It's not handing out bulletins at the door. Like, this is a big problem that I can help solve. Yeah. Sign me up for that. Mm-hmm. And you're right. When you invite people into those rooms, all of a sudden there's an ownership and authority that comes with that that begins to have ramifications rippling through the whole church, that all of a sudden this is my church. This is we're doing this together versus I'm coming here as a spectator to watch whatever you came up with.
All right. I'm going to pivot one more time and I'm going to kind of cook your grits a little bit.
Great. Cook them.
Leadership in the community and where the church is at. Okay. And again, I feel like you have been fully engaged as best as you can in this community. You've built bridges across denominations. You're friends with Bishop Persico and Bishop Brock, and you develop Servieri and still wave that banner, providing leadership there. But our city is still in decline. Mm-hmm. Our kids are still shooting each other. We still have people living in squalor. What's the church's responsibility there?
I think it's twofold. I think that church leaders have to come to the tables where those issues are being talked about. And I think because either they aren't invited to those tables or we refuse to come to those tables, that isn't happening yet as it needs to. So I think that the solution tables of these kind of community issues need to be inhabited by more church leaders. I think that's number one. But number two comes back to this thing that we were just talking about. I do believe, Joel, that there are enough good people in our community who are in our churches who, if they understood that part of their calling from God was not just to serve inside the walls of the church, but to make their job, their career, their work outside of the church, part of their faith journey, that we would see the dials of some of these issues that we're facing start to go in the other direction. And so part of it is, I think the church needs to do a better job equipping the people in our pews to be leaders in the community that they find themselves in, and to be forces for good there, versus trying to separate this idea of that my church life is over here and my work life is over here and never the twain shall meet. Our community is fractured. It really is. There's these invisible lines all over the place of territorialism, and this is my span. I'm not going to go into that space and all this kind of stuff. And that just, it just needs to end. And so, we've been talking, we're trying to create spaces at the Grace Leadership Institute on the church side and otherwise, we're talking about those other disciplines coming into the room. But I think we need to figure out more spaces like that where all of our voices are at the table.
Do you think, let's say if we were talking about the home team, which is kind of the official framework of homelessness in Erie.
Yeah.
Now, the Big C Church is represented there through, maybe Kirk Craze from the EUMA, that's the United Methodist Alliance. There's other faith-based connections, But it's, you don't see a pastor necessarily as part of the home team. Certainly churches are gregarious. I mean, they're very generous in opening their space for the overnight emergency shelters and things. But I guess I'm wondering, what is another level of that?
Here's I've thought this for a long time. First of all, I believe that the church is a sleeping giant. And I feel like community leaders don't understand. And I've experienced this firsthand in conversations that I've had. Communities don't understand that the resource they have in churches. Now, churches have, I want to apologize on behalf of the church, because I don't think churches have been forward enough in their initiatives to get to the space of problem solving. But I think community leaders need to understand that the church, speaking of untapped, the church is an untapped resource in our area, filled with people who are eager to solve problems. One of the things we talk about a ton in Serve Erie is that our number one job is to solve the proximity problem. The proximity problem is that there are good people all over our community sitting in churches who are motivated to do good, who don't see the problems every day.
Yeah.
And they don't come face to face with the problems of our community. They maybe see it on social media, they maybe see it on TV, but there's a proximity problem. And if we can help solve the proximity problem and get good people face to face with the needs and get them trained up so that they can be a part of the solution, man, that's magic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you guys did it. You have an office, a presence, 7th and Holland. It took us to move to 5th and State to understand the significant amount of mental illness that's going on, of homelessness, panhandling and vagrancy. I mean, it's tough. Now, I mean, and there's a lot of critical success factors that are depending upon, you know, us fixing this problem, you know, mm-hmm. of cleaning up State Street, right?
Yeah.
It's a major challenge.
It is,
and I think, like, when I talk to the mayor, I feel like he's not a. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but these are hard things to fix.
Yeah,
you know, poverty is really hard to fix.
Yep.
And
you know, I think that the church is in a space where, you know, there are experts who have skills to help solve these problems. Mm-hmm. We've always thought that the church is the place where we can provide manpower. We can provide people power, and we can be the hands and feet of Christ in the community. And certainly we could be part of the brain power too, but I do think that there are people thinking about solutions to that, because they are complex problems. This is not an easy solution. You know, one of the things that holds us back all the time, we don't want to be riding in on the white horse going, we're the ones to solve all of our right. community's problems. Like, there's a bad taste over that kind of stuff too.
Sure.
And so, you know, but if we can be a player, and if we can tap into that sleeping giant of these really good people in churches who would be part of the solution, but it's going to take an army. You know, I think the key is getting the right people around the right tables. One of my favorite quotes about leadership is actually Hybels. He said, everything rises and falls on leadership.
That's it.
And if you get the right leaders around the right tables, I believe the solutions will come. But there's a lot of nonsense going on in our political world right now that is rigged toward failure. And it's rigged toward gridlock, and it's rigged toward self-preservation instead of actually solving problems. And, you know, I think that plays into this as well, that our systems are not necessarily set up to solve problems wide scale anymore. And so it's like, man, if you can have good people cutting through the nonsense of all of that and just going, we're just going to do good anyway. We're going to come be in relationship. We're going to come provide resource where we can.
Well, you know what's cool is that we're not that big of a town.
That's right.
That we can't. You sit across from a table and have, you know, honest brokers having a conversation about the large issues of our community here. I mean, to me, this is the existential threat of our success, of having our kids and our grandkids stay here is to fix this and to, you know, have our schools vibrant and hit, you know, doing the things that they need to do.
But, and Joel, I mean, yes. I was in a meeting the other day with some community leaders, and they were telling the story of these two groups, two agencies that are doing the absolute same work in our town. They witnessed firsthand the first time those two people have ever talked to each other.
Oh my gosh.
And it's like, to me, it comes back to this fractured nature, this territorial nature. it's like this zero sum thinking, you know, that we're all working in this limited space with these limited resources or whatever. We need to expand our minds around that. Like that, we need to get everybody at the table. And this idea that if you get money, it means I'm not going to get money. And if you get these clients, it means I'm not going to get these clients. And if you get these church people, I'm not going to get my church people. It's just, we're in this together.
That's it. How do people find out more about Grace Leadership Institute?
Easy. They can go to graceleadershipinstitute.com. They can follow us on Facebook or Instagram as well. I would encourage people to sign up. We got some great classes going right now.
There you go. Derek Sanford, lead pastor of Grace Church, dean of the Grace Leadership Institute. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been listening to The Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast from TalkErie.com. Subscribe to our show on your favorite podcatcher and get involved by emailing joel@TalkErie.com.